Welcome to our latest edition of Charity Pulse, our bi-weekly charity podcast. My name is Catherine Rostomji. I head the charities practice at Shakespeare Martineau, and I'm joined today by Charles Mosquita, Charity Director at Quilter Cheviot Investment Management, and James Saunders, Charity Partner at Moore Kingston Smith. Together we explore the latest issues, hoping to give you insight into the latest press stories and other items that we've spotted on our travels. Don't forget, you can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, YouTube, and on our various websites and LinkedIn. Do feel free to subscribe, follow, like, share, whatever you please. We'd love to hear from you with any comments, feedback, or suggestions as well. So, starting with this week, if it was summed up in a word, that word would be toothless, it seems to me. This story seems to have captured the imagination in that the Charity Commission has been described as toothless by Lord Waldney, who has written in the Times this week. It seems to me primarily about the Charity Commission's role in undertaking investigations, which we have talked about on this previously in terms of how long that actually takes for the commission to conduct an inquiry. I did take note of the quote that he'd made: the Charity Commission, currently toothless, must show it can expedite its enormous backlog of investigations or face being broken up. And it was the last bit that caught my eye, and I thought, being broken up by whom? Into what? Is this within the power of Lord Waldney to do that? So I don't know if the two of you had seen this story, whether you had any thoughts on it.
Well, he obviously seems to think he's got the power to do it, which is interesting. I mean, I would agree and disagree with this personally. I'd say he's got a point in that things are very, very, very slow. But I'm not sure that's the Charity Commission's fault. I mean, Catherine, legal matters these days are, you know, drawn out and long, and there is a backlog across all spectrums of the legal side of things. I mean, this is just the way of the world, and I think perhaps Lord Waldney ought to get back in the real world and realise this is the way of things at the moment. So I wouldn't particularly agree with the painfully slow. I would agree that to an extent that it does seem that the Charity Commission is becoming, or seeming to become, toothless. I mean, we've spoken before about, you know, their lack of real action in all sorts of areas, and the lack of them taking responsibility for, you know, recouping monies and generally passing responsibilities back to the trustees, where, frankly, we think that there should be more leadership from the commission. So that's what I reckon.
Charles, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, when I think about toothless, I think about Help Train a Dragon, isn't it?
Yes.
Is the movie, and that always makes me smile. I have to say, I read the article. I didn't know who Lord Waldney was, and so I thought I just wanted to understand what the motivation behind the comments were. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is obviously a guy who's a career politician, started off as a special advisor to John Hutton, and then went on to Gordon Brown, and then was MP for Barron and Furness for 9 years. I'm not quite sure why he stopped when he did. And he was also an independent special advisor for the government on political violence and disruption.
I think he had the whip removed by the Labour Party, Charles. So,
well, I think he was... I think he was actually sacked from that position because it was under, I think it was a Boris Johnson appointment. Anyway, I mean, you know, you've got a guy who's a career politician put up into the Lords, and then he's making a comment about the commission. And I can see absolutely nothing that for the reason behind it. So, I mean, I'd love to understand what that is. I mean, I think they're completely unfounded. So there are three things I think I'd point out. One, commission's budget. And I went back and looked at this. In 2004, it's 28 million. Today, it's 32 million. So it hasn't gone up a huge amount. So I think they do an incredibly good job, you know, with a very limited resources. I mean, they're not inconsequential, but I think we have to take that into account. I think, James, you're absolutely right that if you're going to do an investigation, you need to be, it needs to be considered and it needs to be thorough, and it takes time. And I think it's unrealistic for any regulator to be expected to be acting at speed. And this sort of has a feeling, doesn't it, of a sort of a little bit like journalism, everything we want instantly and solved now. I thought Stephen Bubb made some good comments in defence of the of the commission. And on the subject of breaking it up, I mean, that to me is smacks of putting the regulation back with HMRC. And I'm not sure that would be very healthy or good or would be the right people to be regulating. Because if you remember when the commission got heavily criticised, whenever it was, where they really did find themselves in a bit of a mess, that was the big threat that was coming from the Labour Party at the particular time.
Yeah, I'd agree with you, Charles. I thought the letter back from Sir Stephen Bubb, wasn't it, said these alarmist remarks about the Toothless Commission are unfounded and appear ideologically driven. They do a disservice to our charitable sector. And I thought, yeah, that would sum it up nicely.
Yeah. And just to put it, just so that everybody realises, I mean, they're on the register, what is it, 166,000 charities they're having to regulate, yeah. All different sizes, shapes and things, all doing different things, with a turnover, I think it's about 96 billion. So, you know, I think fundamentally, I think the commission actually does a really, really good job, and it balances the need to be, you know, a firm regulator with one of dealing with a whole lot of volunteers, because that's the other big thing about this is we have a massive amount of volunteers who are trustees and people working, giving their time and everything else. And it is a balancing act. And I think they've overall, over the years that I've known them, actually, I think they should be applauded and not have unfounded criticism like this.
Yeah. So moving from one charity regulator to another, next it's the fundraising regulator. And there's a press article this week about the work of the fundraising regulator in relation to one charity, where it's a mixture of the charity and their fundraising agency, if you like, the fundraising company they were using, breaching the code, having warnings issued to it, complaints being raised. I think one of the issues, it did seem as though the regulator had been quite patient in that they had contacted the Charity Commission for a third time before there was a response from the charity. I think the charity did say that might have been human error and sent apologies. But I think, you know, it does demonstrate, I suppose, the patience of the regulator and trying to get to the bottom of things. But I suppose as well, it's another risk area for charities that potentially damaging their reputation. I wondered, Charles, whether you want to start with this one?
Yeah, I mean, when I read it, I was sort of wondering what being suspended, what would that mean? You know, because it is voluntary, although it's not voluntary. So, and that's the peculiar. I actually sort of think that voluntary thing is a bit of a misnomer. I think the regulator in this particular instance, again, has handled this very well. And I think they've gone to, they've taken it to a stage where they have had no choice. I mean, it's a relatively small charity. I think the turnover is about £300,000 that they're raising money for medical research. And it was to do with plastic bags through one person's door. I mean, it's quite a small issue. So, but I think we need to be careful that we, you know, the regulator is there for a purpose. We have had some poor practices. I think actually the introduction of the regulator has been a good thing, and it has set much better standards. And having somebody independent to investigate when things go wrong. So I hope that the charity reacts appropriately, gets itself off suspension and back in, and deals with the problems at hand.
Yeah, it's a code breach. They say it's a code breach, don't they? But actually, it's multiple elements. I think it's good. Actually, I think that they've obviously, as Charles said, the regulators shown some patience. But ultimately, it's a matter of principle, isn't it? This charity really hasn't taken it seemingly seriously, and hasn't fixed its processes. So I think it's only right that they're shown to pay the penalty, really.
Definitely. An interesting comparison, isn't it? One regulator to another and the different areas where charities do have that interaction. The next piece I'm going to move us on to is the Good Merger Index, where, brace yourselves, but the number of charity mergers increased last year by 31%. And I hear you ask, how many is that overall, Catherine? Well, that would be 63 in total. So yes, it is up, but I think, you know, compared to the 166,000 that Charles has already mentioned, I'm not sure mergers is such a big story, interest, relevance to all charities at the moment. Charles, I know you've had experience personally of a charity merger. Do you see this index and does it make you shudder?
No, every year it comes out and I just think about actually how insignificant it is on the number of mergers that come through. And actually, to me, that shows a bigger issue around the complexity of mergers. I mean, I've been through one. I would never do it again. I've certainly had certainly more grey hairs as a result of it. But I do think fundamentally that there is an opportunity here to do two things. One is I think charities should be working more in partnership. And I think there's a VAT issue. I've raised that before, that if you have shared services, you've got to pay VAT, which seems absolutely nuts. And that, to me, I do think government could resolve, because there would be a big, big benefit around shared services, and that would have no impact on HMRC at all, because they're not getting the money at the moment. And that would save. And if you then get partnerships working effectively, then actually moving into mergers would become, I think, much easier. And I don't know, Catherine, you're the lawyer, if there are easier ways to make a merger from a legal point of view. But I know that the way we did it, which was set up a new charity and merge everything into it, we certainly took the most complex route.
We did.
And I don't think it was, I fought against it when we were doing it. But like everything, you go with the will of the board, and that's what they wanted to do. And to my mind, the motivation to do it was all about being seen to be an independent new charity, where actually I was more interested in doing it as cheaply, quickly as possible and getting us back on the road. But anyway, that was just two different viewpoints.
I noticed that as well, the trend seems to be, or the reported trend was, that actually these mergers were being or were happening because of financial challenges of one party or the other, which, you know, doesn't look great either. These aren't necessarily out of choice or out of positive meaning and intent. They are because some of the charities are struggling and need to merge. They talked about...
But I think, James, if you look at that, sorry to interrupt you, but I think if you look back each year, it's the same thing. It's and that is what's driving the small number of mergers, is because somebody gets... an organisation is in a financial... I was going to say pickle, and they've approached another one to take them over.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, in my one of my subsectors of academy schools, you know, there's a lot of consolidation of academy schools, which are charities, multi-academy trusts merging. So, you know, there are some that actually, I mean, they are relatively straightforward to enact. And I suppose the point here, Charles, referring to your merger experience, where yes, it's, in some cases they can be very, very difficult to manage the culture and the history and the funds and everything, all the complications. In some cases it doesn't have to be quite so difficult in some subsectors. And the academy schools, very, very straightforward really to put together, because they're really, you know, two very like-minded organizations coming together.
But James, is it generally a takeover, not a merger?
Well, I think,
although they may call it a merger.
I would say they are schools coming together. Very many of these multi-academy trusts are coming together to strengthen, you know, to find a combined strengthened position. It is what the government wants in the end. They want these, you know, mid to large size multi-academy trusts. So there's a whole will to make these things happen. And all I'm saying is that, I know you didn't say this, but they don't always have to be highly complex and difficult and structurally complex.
Yeah. And I think we are seeing consolidation. I think that's the other point, isn't it? Is, you know, an element of that. There was reference to 9 of the top 20 mergers, including independent schools, and suggesting that was as a result of the cost of living crisis and the VAT rule change.
That'll be a whole another sector there, a subsector there as well. I mean, to me, the more interesting question than the mergers is actually how charities work in partnership. You know, if there could be more insights and surveys into the changing nature of how charities partner up together, which I'm sure is changing. We've seen this with all charities are far more open-minded to working together. since that pandemic period, and I haven't seen any change, any reduction in that. That's the really interesting moving part here, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay, so our last topic for today, Charles, James and I, looking and learning from you as ever in your recent event hosting charities with AI.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. I've attended an event which there must have been about 70 people at, where we had Sir Anthony Sheldon talking about AI and education. And we also hosted a round table where we had 24 trustees sitting around the table. But what I found fascinating, so we were talking about it from three points. One is that there's an investment element of it, which obviously has been very impactful and in the news. But you've also got the area about should charities implement AI into their organizations, or how do they do it, and everything else. And in both events, the audience seemed to split into two areas. The ones that were very fearful of AI and looking at the what I call the glass half empty, and those looking at the opportunity. And it was really stark of how, a bit like Marmite, isn't it, of people looking at it one way or the other. I mean, I know from our own experience of introducing AI into our business, of which we, you know, we did a pilot study, and then we've rolled it out to the rest of the business. But what has been fascinating is that the productivity gain has been about 20% virtually immediately. The cost of the payback of introducing the IT, which normally you expect it to be a year and a half, has been 3 months. I mean, this has been really quite dramatic. And also, because we're dealing with quite a wide age range from, you know, 20 to those in their sort of 50s and 60s, actually the early adoption of it and those that have embraced it has not been age related. You get either people who will have three or four goes at it, don't succeed, and then we'll sort of put it to one side, or you get those that are a bit more tenacious, which will do. And it is definitely transforming the way. The other big issue that was discussed, we didn't really get into it into a huge amount, was around the ethics. So you've got the environmental issue about the use of energy, and then you've got the human issue. So I think this is a really fascinating area. But I think if charities aren't looking at it, they should be looking at this. There is a massive opportunity. I know for us as the big, I mean, we use Copilot, but that's because we can actually control the information and not allow it out into the, where if you're using ChatGPT, whatever you're supplying in and asking, it's using and thing. And the other final thing about AI is that it is a tool. I mean, we've got our analyst who describes it like a hammer, and it's how you use it rather than seeing it as the panacea and it's going to replace everything. So you do have to, you know, you can use it. We use it for this, don't we? Mm-hmm. But you still have to apply your own common sense and sense check it. You can't just let it go straight out.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think people often just say AI. What do you mean by that? Is that automation? Is that being used in a certain way? James, are you coming across AI in your audit work?
Bit by bit, yes. And we've got a digital transformation team who are very, involved in not just our own AI developments, but our industry. You know, they work with the ICAW, for example, and groups like that to look at this. I mean, this is all about understanding for me. It's all about understanding, as you said, Catherine, understanding what the tools are. And Charles, as you were saying, understanding the risks, really. And one of the big risks for charities must be the security of data. And I think you sort of alluded to it earlier, but invariably there will be sensitive data, and highly sensitive data in some cases, with charities that are working with vulnerable sections of the community, or, you know, people with all sorts of sensitive data in their name. That's a massive risk for charities. And I'm not saying don't do it, but you've got to understand where your risks are using AI for anything to do with data storage or communication or anything like that. But, you know, as long as you've got an understanding of your of what the things are and what your risks are, you're getting there.
But I think most charities are going to be probably using Microsoft. Not that I'm promoting or being paid by Microsoft to promote it, but I know that we have used Copilot, and although I wasn't part of the process of selection, but the reason has been around our ability to put those protections around the risk. I think you're right to be aware of them, but also I think people shouldn't be. This is changing so fast. I mean, it's interesting. I was talking to the guy who was within our business, who was in charge of doing the pilot study. It was one of our IMs, and I asked him what are the one thing he would do differently now, looking down 12 months on. And he said, "I wouldn't have had a pilot study." He said, "The problem is what we learned at the beginning, because this is changing so much and so fast, actually was not really useful or relevant going forward, and it was much more."
Yeah, I mean, but again, that depends on the content, doesn't it? I mean, you know, we as Catherine suggested, we use AI in our audit work. Now, you cannot just go, well, we're using AI, and you know, and that's how we use it. There's still got to be the human element. So you've always got to have, you know, you've got to work out how you are going to use these things, not just use them. And you know, in my world, stick these things on the audit file, and that's our evidence. It's still got to be reviewed, but whatever you do, you've got to have the human element, and and that's why I say you've got to understand the extent of the use of the AI and what the AI can do, and really what it means for you.
But the one thing I found from a personal basis of embracing this new technology is the part of me really excited with the power of what it can do. But my biggest fear is, am I using it properly and appropriately and to its full potential, which I am certainly not. But the lovely thing about this is that if you keep playing with it, you just get better and better and better and better. But you're absolutely right. If you think it's just going to resolve the problem for you, then that's not what this is going to do. A lot of heavy lifting for an awful lot of manual work, because it can do it at such a speed of which you can't, which then allows you to focus on the more complex and more interesting areas. I suspect, Catherine, you with the law will have exactly the same thing.
Yeah, and I think it's both of your points. It's using it in the right way for the right purpose, with a human doing a lot of sense checking and oversight, and you know, not relying on a tool 100%. I think it's that nuance, isn't it, of saying there's a balance there, and that it's an opportunity, but you know, think of the risks as well.
And funnily enough, Sir Anthony Sheldon gave the printing press as a really good example of something as revolutionary, that he puts AI in that same bracket. You know, electricity might be another one of just completely transforming. But the printing press is a good analogy, isn't it? Because you've got, again, that very big split of people fearful of what the impact will be to those that the opportunity. But actually, from a human point of view, the education and everything else was hugely enhanced as a result of it.
Catherine, what about content creation and AI is obviously a big legal matter. And I was related to that. I was quite interested the other day. We've got interviews for, you know, for our trainee intaker. And I reckon when some of the applications come through and they talk about, you know, why do you want to work for this company? There's some stuff on there that is clearly AI generated. You know, it's not, it's very generic. It's not specific. Now, I'm not averse to people using AI. I think they should probably say if they're using AI in like job applications, because it shows a bit of initiative that you are using it. But I reckon if I can spot AI generated content on a job application, I'm not sure that's really A, how it should be used. It should be used to help you. And you, I mean, legally, there's presumably at the moment, it's quite unfounded territory, isn't it?
It is. You know, it's out there. And I think I possibly mentioned this on a previous session, but I did take on a new client where they'd been refused registration at the Charity Commission. And one of the feedback points from the commission was, this application has been written using AI. And their, you know, comment on that was, this is not a genuine application. That is not you answering the questions. That is, you know, feeding it into a funnel, coming with an answer at the other end, dropping it into the application, not good enough, not accepting. So I think it is, you know, for different I suppose, bodies to say, do they accept AI-generated text?
Okay, having supported the Charity Commission earlier, I actually think that they are being a bit short-sighted here, because I think if somebody just produces an application without any form of human intervention from their part and presents it to the commission, then okay, maybe that's valid. But I think it sends the wrong message, that the commission saying, oh, no, you can't produce this using AI. Because it's interesting what the universities are doing. And of course, they've had a massive issue with this, haven't they? And where before they were very concerned, they've actually, if Sadie Sheldon is, which I suspect he is, an authority on this, is that they've had to work out how to embrace this, because they have a whole lot of students that are going to use it. And so they're having to say, okay, fine, how are we going to use this as a tool rather than something to demonstrate that you actually don't have the knowledge?
Very interesting, isn't it? I think definitely one for the sector to think about. So thank you, Charles and James. Another interesting session covering a wide range of topics. Thank you for joining us. If you do have any questions, comments, feedback, suggested topics for future sessions, do let us know. And feel free to share far and wide. We'd love to reach as wide an audience as possible and to hear your views in due course. So thank you for joining us.